back, everyone, for this third and final segment of our conversation with Al Snyder, Chief Master Sergeant, United States Air Force, retired. It's been our pleasure to get some key insights on leadership from Al, who experienced leadership, both good and bad, as a young airman, and later provided leadership as a seasoned command sergeant, responsible for over 2,500 enlisted men and women in the 4th Weather Wing. Al now continues by explaining how styles of leadership must be able to meet the specific tasks at hand. That's no small trick. He finally draws a parallel between a major tenet of leadership and a quote from Scripture that explains best how to relate to subordinates, peers, and superiors alike. We will pick up where we left off.
I saw a list the other day of characteristics of good leadership styles. Al, what can you tell us about leadership style?
Well, again, I'm not the world's greatest authority. I'm far from it, but I do have a goodly amount of experience, both academically and in actually being a leader or a supervisor, and I do have some strong feelings about certain aspects of it. I was drugged, as I said in one of the other subjects that I talked about, I was drugged kicking and screaming into the world of being a leader. I did not want to. I fancied myself as a very good technician. And only, as I said earlier, when it was explained to me that I could continue to be a technician, I just needed to realize I wasn't going to get promoted again, that I decided maybe I needed to change my priorities. And so I got into the world of leadership. First shop, I had 6 people working for me, and then it expanded to I had nearly 200. And then a very interesting thing happened. Apparently, whatever I was doing by instinct as a leader, and to be honest with you, I'm not even sure that I was thinking all that much about how and why, the how and why of leading people as I was doing it. I was just doing what I instinctively thought was best. It turns out apparently that was pretty good because we had a management team that came through our organization, and at the end of their 2-week visit, one of them sat down with me and asked me if I'd ever thought of doing anything bigger for the Air Force. And then I was invited to join their team subsequently and become an Air Force management consultant. That's where I began to learn through the academic world and then the management consulting world. I spent a lot of time in class learning leadership theory, and then I spent a lot of time on the road traveling through various Air Force organizations that were troubled and were having problems performing their missions effectively or efficiently. And I learned over a period of 3 years a lot more about leadership than I had ever known before, because I saw the failures of people and jobs, and I was able to find out why and ferret out the reasons that these things failed or were not working as effectively, and help the people within the organizations put together an action plan to change what was going on to solve those problems. It was an almost painful growing exercise because I found out there was so much about being a leader that I didn't know, that I almost began to question myself as to how good I theoretically was before I came to it. The Leadership Management Development Center of the Air Force was a very interesting organization. I learned a lot academically and theoretically about leadership, and then I got to see a lot of it in action, effectively and not effectively, and I was able then to change the course of organizations, their people, and their processes in order to make them more effective. I learned an awful lot. To leadership style, while I was there, admittedly probably before I became a leader, I had heard discussions and had some small amounts of training along that line, but basically not a lot. But from the time I got there in 78 until I left in 1981, to go to a bigger organization and back to my original career field, I learned about all kinds of leadership styles. And subsequent to being there with the management teams, for the rest of my career in the Air Force and for the full 15 years that I was working in the credit and collections industry, the corporation that I worked for believed in continued training and continued learning. And I'll tell you, it just got to be, in terms of leadership style, it got to be almost the theory or the style du jour for me, the style du jour. Every day there was a new style that we should embrace and try to use. And I got so fed up with it, I just reflected back on all of those styles that I had seen and decided that the best of all was the one that I learned back in 1978 and 79 and used throughout my career and taught to everybody that I could. Credit due here to the two people that put this theory together, and that would be Hersey and Blanchard. Pardon me for not knowing the first names in this discussion. Hersey was, I believe, the president of the School of Business of an Ivy League university, and Blanchard was a retired Navy admiral. And the two of them developed a model called situational leadership. I will tell you that when somebody, and I've heard people say this, you say, so what's your theory on leadership, or how do you practice being a boss? And somebody says to me that, oh, you know, I'm an authoritarian. I'm a take charge guy. I'm a type A personality, get out there and lead, hands-on guy. Or I'm kind of a laid-back individual. I kind of let the folks do their thing, you know, try to stay out of their way. Anytime somebody tells me they have a particular leadership style, I just cringe, because you can't be an effective leader in all situations if you only have one style of leadership. Hersey and Blanchard put forth their theory as a continuum of leadership styles that go from one extreme, being the authoritarian, the autocrat, the dictator, all the way back to the other end of the continuum, which is the laissez-faire, the hands-off, the let me know how it's going type leader. And they said that on any given day in any given work group, you had to be a leader, and you chose the style of leadership based on three things. And the three things make sense, really, in common sense. They're the maturity of your followers, the ability of those followers to do the job, and the situation at hand. Now, the maturity of the followers. If I put it in military terms, obviously, if you're the leader of a group of first-term military people who only have one or two stripes and they're young, then they obviously are going to take more hands-on, direct, authoritative leadership than some group of people who are much farther advanced in their career, have more rank, more skills, more maturity. And those people are going to have, you know, a far lesser degree of direct guidance necessary because they're capable of doing it all themselves. And these two things, the maturity of the followers, as well as their ability to do the job. Now, again, just because somebody's mature doesn't mean they have the ability to do the job. Maybe they've recently just come to that job. Maybe they've recently cross-trained, or maybe they've recently been hired into the company into a new job that they're not as familiar with. So while those may be mature followers, they wouldn't necessarily have the ability to do their job. That too would require more training, more hands-on leadership from you. But the third determinant is one that is as important as any of the others, because that's the situation at hand. Because even if you have lots of mature followers and they all have the ability to do the job, there are some situations at hand, not just in the military, in the civilian world as well, that require you to perhaps even rapidly, on any given day, at any given time, change from a kind of hands-off, let them do their job, they're doing fine, and very rapidly transition into being a very directive leader, one who is in charge of everything. And an example of that I would give you is, let's take a firehouse, a fire station. If you're the chief of that particular fire station, you may, on any given shift, you may find yourself, because you have mature firefighters, you may have younger ones, you have captains or lieutenants who are intermediate level supervisors, but you have people who are at all levels of being very efficient and are leaders themselves. Then you have those who are capable and they do training. They're quite proficient at their job. And then there are the younger ones coming in, perhaps the cadets out of school. Those are the ones that are getting more hands-on training and what have you. But these people are all, on any given day, doing their regular job in the firehouse. And you may not really have a direct contribution to that and may find yourself up in your office doing paperwork, at the endless reams of which seem to come to leaders as they get higher up in organizations. So you're really basically being a laissez-faire or hands-off person, because there's no need for you to be down there interfering and disturbing the flow of work with your presence. You're just busy with paperwork. And so you're at the laissez-faire end of the continuum, when suddenly the alarm bell goes off and there's a fire somewhere. Well, the bottom line of that situation is you are in charge of that unit, and you are responsible and going to be held responsible for getting your people out to the fire and putting down that fire as fast as possible, rescuing people and doing whatever else has to be done. And only at some point, as the fire gets knocked down to an acceptable level and you feel you can hand off control to your other subordinate leaders, only then can you begin to relax and move back down the continuum to the less directive leader and let them handle it, because they're capable of doing that. So that's the situation at hand. It can change at any time. But how you handle a leadership event, whether you're being laissez-faire, whether you are moving up the continuum to where you are tasking people to do things and then letting them develop the plans and do them, or failing that if they need more guidance and more help, where you're getting into kind of directive and coaching of them, or whether you continue on until you're into the more direct involved, more authoritative leadership. Those are the various styles, the four primary styles, and simply it's an increase in your involvement and authority from little or none to completely in charge. Those situations will change, again, very fluid every day, and your job as a leader is to identify what is the appropriate style of leadership based on those three things that I said: the maturity of your followers, the ability of the followers to do their job, and the situation at hand. You can't just be a one-style manager. It isn't going to work for you in every situation, and you aren't going to be as effective as you could be otherwise. So let's remember what Hersey and Blanchard set up for us and gave an awful lot of thought to. By the way, that theory is still out there, and their information is available out on the line, or out on the web. So this is not a theory that has just drifted into the past. It's still current and vital to this day, and it will serve you well if you learn it better and you try to effectively use it.
Leadership also includes the ability to motivate the troops, those we supervise. You have some interesting ideas about that, Al.
Well, I do. Rod, I want to talk about something that's very near and dear to me, the subject of recognition. I want to share these thoughts, and I don't mean recognition for you as a leader. I mean recognition for your people. Again, those people that work for you are going to make you a success or a failure. If you haven't got that message so far, please, that's a foot stomper. Pay attention to it. And when you recognize your people for work that they have done, that gets you great return value and commitment because it builds equity between you and the people who follow you, because they then know that the boss appreciates what they're doing and the effort that they're putting forth for that boss as well as for the company et al. So recognition is very important. Now, what do I mean by recognition? Normally speaking, there are two recognition programs that go on within a company. There's the visible formal recognition programs, and examples of those are, of course, the employee of the month, the technician of the quarter, the outstanding manager. In the military, it's the non-commissioned officer of the year, and many other levels of recognition. These are all formal. They're usually published in company guidelines, and these are the ones that carry tangible rewards. This is where you get the very familiar plaque. You get the presentation in front of the folks that you work with from the boss or somebody within the company at a higher level. And nice words and meaningful things are said, and there are tangible gifts beyond the plaque. Sometimes they're monetary gifts, things like that, merchandise gifts. But they come, and these are important programs because they're visible. But many times these are already institutionalized within an organization. And let's take an organization we've been dealing with. Let's just take an example of maybe a company that's got 300 people. If you put together all of your formal recognition programs, as I say, for your employees, your technicians, your outstanding managers, for the month, the quarter, the year, if you put all of that together, you may recognize 30 or 40 of the employees of that company, maybe even 50, in any given year. But my question to you as a leader would be, if you've recognized 40 people out of 300, what recognition do the other 260 people working for you get if they're not going to get the plaque, the certificate, the photographs, the tangible rewards, the gift certificates, the whatever? What do the rest of them get? Basically, nothing, unless you do something about it. And that's where the second part of recognition comes in, not formal recognition, but informal recognition. That's the recognition that you give out as their supervisor, and it's either verbal or it's written. Verbally, it's the traditional pat on the back as you go by. It's the attaboy. You get up from your desk and you get out amongst the workers and you make sure that you're visible and you make sure that they know that you care about them. You must be careful and not make it sort of plastic. You know, it's on your calendar at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Ooh, time to jump up and run out amongst the troops and tell them all how good they are. No. But make sure that you're out there aperiodically within the various work centers of your people, seeing how things are going, not out there mucking about and undoing some of your subordinate supervisors, but being out there in a non-threatening manner. This is what gives you the opportunity to pat a guy on the back and give him an attaboy and say the traditional things like, hey, Bob, great job on that briefing this morning. You've been putting in a lot of extra time on this project lately, Teresa, and I really appreciate it. Things like that, simple words, verbal pats on the back and attaboys will get you more rewards and more payback than you ever realize. When the boss goes by and says good things to you, it simply recharges your psychic battery, some people more than others. I myself, when I got recognized for something, I was good for another couple of weeks or a month, just because that's the way I was wired. But not recognizing them leaves them out there wondering if anybody really appreciates what they're doing. And you don't want followers who don't know that they're not appreciated. You want them to feel appreciated and participating in and part of something bigger than themselves. And that's your job and your subordinate supervisor's jobs to do that. Now, you can also do it a little bit more impact. You can add to the verbal by giving them a written letter. And this can be anything from a very formal letter of commendation from yourself to somebody for a particular job that they did well. Or it could be just a less formal note scribbled out from, you know, from the desk of Al Snyder. And it just says, hey, great job yesterday on doing this, and really appreciate having you on board, and signed. And you'll be surprised where those things end up. They frequently end up on the walls or in the work areas posted by the individual that you sent them to, just because the people are proud of it and they want it to be up there on display. Even something as simple as just grabbing a little yellow Post-it note and scribbling out, great job, way to go, Terry, and sending that to them, or just sticking it on the on their desk. These are all ways you can put it in writing. Remember to make a copy of it and throw it in their personnel file so you'll have it available for their performance review next time. So that recognition I wanted to talk about, and I want to put one other thing in here about recognition, which really is more under the heading of job performance feedback. I have done so many performance feedback reviews, you know, the ubiquitous annual performance review, which I personally think should be a heck of a lot more often, because why should an associate, why should a follower have to wait 1 year to find out what you think of their performance? My gosh, if they could have found out the same thing 9 months before, if you did a quarterly or a six-month review with them, or if you just did a review with them at the time that you thought there were some changes needed to be made for the better or whatever, then you would have more productive time with them having this knowledge than having to wait all the way till the end of 12 months when you're going to share these pearls of wisdom with them on how they could improve themselves. But what I wanted to get at is this. The format that I recommend that you use, I have done it. I learned it. Experience tells me it's the right way to go. If you're going to sit down with somebody and review their performance, it's going to be under the heading of recognition, or that at least is going to fall into that mix. The format that I suggest you use on this is good, bad, good. It's the way you should go into a performance review. If you take the individual off-site and you go to a non-threatening place like lunch or something like that, and make no mistake, going to lunch on the performance review day is not really relaxing, because throughout the entire meal they know what's coming afterward anyway. But use the good, bad, good method. In other words, you go into the process telling them the things that you see that they're doing good and how valuable they are to the team. Then you slide into the areas of performance which need improvement and can use bolstering and training and an uptick. And you go over those with them and then slide back out into the positive, adding it together and saying, so, given that your performance is this strong and you do this much for us, if you could pick up these two areas and bring them up to this level and do this for us and perhaps improve this, then you put that together, that's going to be a total package and a real performer, and I'm glad to have you on the team. In other words, you've gone into it gently, reminding them how valuable they are to the team, But then sliding into the, however, we've got some areas we can definitely improve on and make you an even better player. And then if we can do that, well, then you'll be a great member of the team and even more valuable than you are now. There's the positive exit. So use the good, bad, good. Again, that's part of recognition, but it also ties in with performance reviews. I once asked an individual when I was a management consultant, I asked this question many times because I was always going somewhere with the reason that I asked it. And I asked an individual, so how well do you do your job? I was trying to find out about recognition in the organization that I was consulting with. I said, so how well do you do your job? And he said, oh, I do it really well. I said, really, on a 1 to 10 scale, where would you put yourself? And he said, oh, probably a 9. I said, how do you know that? And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, well, he said, you know, nobody's come out and chewed me out for at least a year. I'd like to suggest to you that the absence of negative feedback is not positive feedback. Just because he had never been chewed out or hadn't been chewed out that year for doing something didn't mean that his performance was outstanding. It may have meant that his performance was simply barely adequate and just ahead of being chewed out. So you've got to give them feedback so that they know how effective they're being and how you perceive their contribution to the overall goal, so that they know where they are. Because the sad part is in the individual employee who thinks they're doing great, when in reality, they're just one step ahead of being fired. How unfair to them is that? I'm going to encourage you to keep the feedback going to your people, keep recognizing them. And I want to leave you, as we approach the end of this series of thoughts on leadership, I want to leave you with a final thought. So as we're closing this session, the absolute best, the simplest piece of guidance for leaders young and old was actually the inspired word of God in the Bible, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It ties in perfectly with situational leadership, the model of Hersey and Blanchard that I mentioned earlier, and in my mind at least, it's the absolute best rule as a leader. If you think about, let's say, an awkward moment where you're going to have to go talk to somebody about how they're failing on the job or some particular aspect of the job that just went really, really wrong. Stop for a moment, put yourself in their shoes, and think, if I had just done that, how would I want the boss to treat me? What would I want him or her to say? And then go back into your own shoes and go forth and handle it that way. The golden rule is applicable across the board at every level of leadership. And as I say, it fits perfectly with situational leadership. So that's my final thought to you. I wish you the absolute best and the greatest degree of success you can have at your job and your future positions of leadership. Thank you.
Well, Al, that's a great place to wrap up. Leading others as you would have them lead you. Well, our thanks goes out to Alan Snyder, retired Chief Master Sergeant, United States Air Force, first of all, for the many years of service that you gave to this country, and now for your insights that you shared with us about leadership and the lessons you have learned in your career. Al, thanks so much.
Well, Rod, I appreciate you asking me into this series and placing your faith in me. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to kind of hold forth and talk about things that I experienced, I learned, I taught, I did, and things that I hold very close to my heart in terms of the people who work for me. Thank you.
So that's quite evident, and we want to thank you again. At this point, this wraps up our series. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. God bless. Bye-bye.